I Hate the News is the weekly news bulletin from I Hate Politics podcast, a show about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. The week of October 15th, 2024, a conflict of interest story drops into Maryland's U.S. Senate race. The Montgomery County Muslim Council releases its election recommendations with no choice between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. We have the first ever UMBC state politics poll directed by veteran Maryland pollster Malia Cromer. And Maryland's Housing Secretary Jake Day weighs in on the meaning of Democratic input in housing policy and a new plan to deal with vacant homes in Baltimore City. And more. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program. If your goal is to make a meaningful impact with a career in local, state, or federal government, discover what this degree can do for you. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society functioning precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaricino on guitar and vocals, Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals, Evan Hurd on bass, and Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends. The elections are now 3 weeks away, and everyone seems to be waiting for the October surprise. Midway through the month, nothing yet. Kamala Harris reported raising $1 billion since entering the race. Disaster response in North Carolina and Florida were politicized. Maryland's U.S. Senate race between Angela Alterbrooks and Larry Hogan received a jolt from a story by reporter Eric Cordalisa, alleging that the former governor, Larry Hogan's administration, had awarded several affordable housing contracts to clients of the real estate brokerage house, which he co-owned with his brother. Hogan dismissed the allegations as old and disproven. Delegate Mark Corman, a Democrat and the chair of the Environment and Transportation Committee in the Maryland General Assembly, who oversees ethics issues, has promised legislative action on conflict of interest, requiring governors to put their assets into a blind trust. Corman wrote on Twitter that current Governor Wes Moore did put his assets into a blind trust, but Hogan did not when he was governor. Even before the allegations dropped, Alterbrooks, the Prince George's County executive, appears to have been pulling ahead, according to the first ever UMBC poll, which was conducted in the last week of September, but released October 9th. For more on the poll, here is Malia Cromer, who ran a state poll from Goucher College for years and has now joined the faculty at UMBC.
What we found right now is Angela Alterbrooks is currently leading the race. She's outside of the margin of error. So 49% of Maryland likely voters say they are going to vote for Alterbrooks. 38% say they're going to vote for former Governor Larry Hogan. The rest of the folks either say some third party or other candidate, and about 5% are undecided at this point.
How close is that or not to the partisan breakdown in the state?
A unique feature of this race is that we have a Republican running that has been able to make this race competitive. Everybody knows that there's a 2-to-1 Democratic to Republican ratio. Here in Maryland, Democrats just dominate electoral politics, except for these sort of weird anomaly, almost Hogan years, where he was able to build as governor, a really sort of broad bipartisan coalition where about a third of Democrats cast their ballot for him in 2018. What we see right now, in our poll at least, he's only getting around about 14 or 15% of Maryland Democratic voters, and he needs more to win. So in the next couple of weeks, if he hopes to kind of close the gap on Alsobrooks, he is going to have to appeal very heavily to moderate to conservative Democrats and try to rebuild that Hogan coalition. And Angela Alsobrooks has proven that she is a fierce competitor. And I think that of everybody he has faced electorally, she has been, I think, the most formidable person he has faced.
Now, other polls are much closer between Alsobrooks and Hogan. Do you understand the difference, why that might be?
So, the poll that was taken right before ours was the Washington Post poll in partnership with the University of Maryland. And they actually had a little bit slightly larger spread in favor of Alsobrooks than we did, marginally, like within the margin of error kind of spread. So what we have seen, if I talk about the trends, since Alsobrooks and Hogan won their respective primaries, right out of the gate, the first initial polling over the summer, we saw like a really close race, like effectively tied between the two. But as like after Labor Day, as time sort of has marched on and Alsobrooks' messaging has gotten out, she has slowly started to pull ahead of the governor. And that's effectively mostly among Democrats. That's how she has been able to put this distance, because she has prevented the Democrats who have voted even for Hogan in the last two election cycles. They are coming back to support her.
I was looking at the favorability, unfavorability ratings, and it seems that really that is a artifact of the partisan breakdown in the state itself.
It really is. And so Hogan right now has a 53% favorability rating, 42% unfavorable rating. I will note that 42% is higher than we have seen in the past. So his unfavorables have ticked up over time. When he was governor and we were doing just approval ratings of him, oftentimes he would have a disapproval rating only in like the 20% somewhere. So the Alsobrooks campaign, and I would say like a full effort from the Maryland Democratic Party, because my goodness, although I don't think Twitter is real life, there is a unified voice from Maryland Democrats really trying to knock down Hogan's sort of numbers, make him viewed a little bit less favorably. But mostly they're doing that by tying him to the larger National Republican Party.
Given those numbers, the fact that abortion is such a small issue in the issue set, it's kind of startling.
Well, okay, I think we should look at the abortion issue a couple different ways. And so one of the cool things I thought that we did on this poll was among Alsobrooks supporters, so the folks who said I'm voting for Angela Alsobrooks, and then the folks who said I'm voting for Larry Hogan, we followed up with those individuals and said, hey, why? Why are you doing it? Like, what's your main reason? A full quarter of them offered up that they're voting for Alsobrooks to maintain Democratic control of the Senate. And then a smaller subsample said specifically it's about abortion rights. That is significant to me. And not only that, Alsobrooks has done a good job. And if you watch the debate, you'll see it. Anytime she talks about reproductive rights, she talks about it in terms of the control of the Senate. And it does show up in our polling and other places too, the importance of reproductive rights for Marylanders. We also ask like, what are critical or like a big crucial issue for you? So the cost of living is really high. That's a big issue for folks. Crime and public safety, another big issue. But abortion comes up. 57% of Maryland likely voters say abortion is a big issue for them. So it does matter. And it's especially important because Alsobrooks has messaged the two together, control the Senate with abortion together.
Malia Cromer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
The Montgomery County Muslim Council, a body that routinely provides election guidance for its members, has issued recommendations for the upcoming elections without making a choice between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. The body has not offered any reasoning for its choices, even though there is a QR code on the announcement promising one. The unwillingness to make a choice seems to be an indictment of the Biden-Harris-Israel policy and looks past Donald Trump's 2017 Muslim travel ban. This choice is widely debated in Muslim communities around the country and could very well have an impact on elections in states like Michigan, which has a significant Arab population. In Montgomery County and Maryland, the overwhelming Democratic presence makes the choice a protest, but not determinative of election results. The group has also decided not to endorse incumbent Glenn Ivey in Congressional District 4. Ivey is widely expected to prevail. For local Board of Education, the group appears to have chosen candidates more supportive of their efforts to pull students out of MCPS classrooms over LGBTQ books they are opposed to. You can listen to interviews with all six Board of Education candidates on I Hate Politics. Search on your favorite streaming platform using the name of the podcast and the name of the candidate. Local politics used to be a trifecta: education, transportation, and public safety. Add housing to this. Housing and zoning, which for decades were settled issues as politics battled over education, traffic, and crime, is increasingly a hot-button issue in local politics over the last several years. Montgomery County, as other jurisdictions around the country, is considering a proposal to allow increased density in single-family zoned areas. In last Tuesday's news episode, I had addressed the issue of whether this measure covering land area 1 mile around transit hubs was sufficiently broad to make more land available so that real estate developers stop waiting on projects and put shovel to the ground. For this week's show, Maryland Housing Secretary Jake Day joined us to talk about a state plan to deal with vacant homes in Baltimore. And I also asked him about the nature of Democratic input in housing policy. Governor Moore just signed an executive order to reduce vacant homes in the city. How does it work?
Baltimore Vacant Reinvestment Initiative, which is the new name for a redesigned Project Core, which was up to $20 million a year that was going into the city to address vacancy with demolition and stabilization dollars. That is now $50 million a year, and it's statutory, thanks to Delegate Stephanie Smith. So over the 15-year time horizon of the plan, that represents $750 million into Baltimore City. The second piece of it is that we have launched Baltimore Vacant Reinvestment Council. That body will be chaired by me, vice-chaired by the city's commissioner of housing. The entity will take responsibility for a property-by-property constant assessment of the condition and disposition, as well as sources and uses planning of taking the state dollars, the city dollars, philanthropy, and even hopefully leveraging federal dollars to address particular designed uses, such as, again, acquisition, demolition, stabilization, homeowner incentives, and developer incentives.
You said the problem of vacant homes is not just in Baltimore. I know it's in Cumberland. I know it's in the Eastern Shore. You know that. Why choose Baltimore?
The scale requires state partnership and state accountability, holding the partners accountable to results, which is a departure from the past, admittedly. There exists a program as well that is designed to address vacancy in those places called the Strategic Demolition Fund. It's scaled, I think, appropriately, though we are always looking to grow resources.
In Arlington County in Virginia, a judge struck down the missing middle law and the permitting department is scrambling to roll things back. How are you looking at judicial intervention when you try to get more density?
We put a lot of faith in the judiciary in Maryland, particularly through the Governor's Housing Expansion and Affordability Act that the General Assembly passed last year, that they would help to define what is unreasonable regulation that affects density, viability, and affordability of projects. And so we've got a lot of faith. That doesn't mean that they're always going to make decisions that we agree with. You know, That's not the only way that we put a lot of faith and trust in the judiciary. We've put a lot of faith in them in Baltimore City. The capacity of the court system to help us get out of the vacancy problem that we have in the city is a critical choke point. I want to be advocate number one for getting them the resources they need to do the work.
So why not? Why is that not included in the $77 million you just talked about?
Why is that operating funding not included?
You need the courts, but you know they are clearly short of resources. Why not add a few million dollars necessary to bring that along? I mean, you're already spending 77.
Yeah, I think that's a conversation that we're going to be having this budget cycle, whether it's state, city, or both of us, as well as philanthropy. The ABLE Foundation in Baltimore City has put dollars forth that the city has matched to expand court capacity, court clerks, as well as to stand up the in-rem docket, the in-rem foreclosure docket.
You are dependent on philanthropy to do this?
Philanthropy's got to play a role. Absolutely.
On the court side?
I don't think that's the long-term solution to operating funding for government function like the courts. But I think it is. I think it is really telling that it was the ignition key in Baltimore City to getting the city to put in dollars.
Operating budget for the judges?
Maybe not what we would have designed, but it's there, and it's it instigated action.
Other question I had for you is that in Montgomery County, the similar situation with the new attainable housing initiative, the county council has been organizing listening sessions, and overwhelmingly there is opposition to the proposal. This raises the question of what is democratic input? Now, I know that you had also tweeted saying that the people in the room aren't the only ones speaking, and you were tweeting out Greater Washington poll that showed a broader support in the citizenry at large rather than the people that attend hearings. These listening sessions had a very strong role in our democracy, are losing that role because they are not representative. And that you are actually interested more in the polling and believe those to be more accurate about public preferences.
I think the way we design public engagement generally in America is set up to draw out the worst in us. Even when I can agree and acknowledge we have a problem, you're not giving me a space to be constructive or to design solutions. You're giving me a space to yell about one thing. And I only want one thing out of you, and that's a no vote. I think if we designed public process differently, where it's constructive, team-oriented, solution-oriented, where people are forced to think about how to solve the problem, and they don't get to leave the table or leave the room after they've said their 2 minutes that they pre-wrote, that would be a far more constructive debate and dialogue. So I don't know what is really achieved by listening sessions like this.
Have you talked to Montgomery County Council people about this?
I think in the wake of what you pointed out about the feedback that they're getting on this topic, I do think it's worth a conversation.
The true paradox is going to be that despite the overwhelming opposition to the Attainable Housing Initiative, it is my expectation that the county council is going to pass it. So it really raises the question of democratic input.
And whether or not the style of input produced meaningful results. Because I'm sure they're talking to other people, right? I'm sure they're having their own conversations. They're finding ways to listen to input. And there are polls. And those polls aren't make-believe. You know, it's the opinion of voters too. And it's just as relevant as, if not more so, because it's broader, as who showed up at a certain time at a certain place. Public hearings are not in and of themselves designed to be representative of the community. We might fool ourselves into thinking so. But you pick a time and a place and say, whoever shows up there, who got the message, that's representative of the community. It's not. It's not.
Jake Day, thank you.
Sunil, a lot of fun. Thank you.
Montgomery County Council's Office of Legislative Oversight last month released a report looking at the police department's implementation of the 2020 use of force and no-knock warrant law to find that MCPD policy still allows neck restraints when deadly force would be authorized, despite the county law prohibiting such action. Other than that, MCPD's use of force policy appears to be in line with the new law. Montgomery County Public Schools will use $2 million to buy and install vape detectors in all high school restrooms. The money comes from the county's share of the state of Maryland's settlement with the e-cigarette company, Juul. That's all for this episode. Be sure to check out our feature interview series that comes out Friday mornings. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaricino on guitar and vocals. Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals. Evan Hurd on bass. And Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends.